My dear brothers and sisters, our Lord and Savior Jesus, our topic for this morning is announced has been his brother Reen Grocott, or Gilbert Victor Grocott, which was his actual name, and his work in the Lord. Now we have some advantages over other speakers who have gone before us, and some disadvantages. There is not a biography or an autobiography written on Brother Grocott. Brother Thomas had a biography written by Brother Roberts called Life and Works. And Brother Roberts wrote his own autobiography on his ways and his days. There is no such work on Brother Grocott. On the other hand, I'm the only one who actually had the opportunity to talk directly to my subject. I corresponded with Brother Grocott for 8 years, and I even spent a week snowed into his basement flat with him in Detroit in 1978 during a late winter blizzard. Brother Craig Kiley said as I was waiting for this talk that he looked forward to it, as all he had ever heard before were brethren talking about Brother Grocott. Well, when done today, that is still all he will have heard, because that's all we can do is talk about our experiences that we had with Brother Grocott. Never as we spoke to him did we ever consider gathering material for a biography or writing one. And my talk this morning will not really be about Brother Grocott personally, as a biography would, but rather about his work in the truth and his effect on the brotherhood in his lifetime. Brother Grocott's work was done at a time when the truth was very tumultuous. The judges speak of the children of Israel following them coming into the land and receiving the law. And the judges make a note about how long they were able to hold on to the truth. We read there in Judges 2 and 7, "And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that he did for Israel." Now, I suppose folks can debate about how long this period actually was, but it seems to be about 120 years. That's determined by the 40 years work of Moses, the 30 years that Joshua ruled, making 70 years, and for probably somewhere around 50 years for the time the men who learned the truth in the days of Joshua but outlived him, them learning the truth in their 20s and probably dying after 70, or about 50 years. So we see the time frame, if we consider the growth of the truth following the destruction of the commonwealth of Israel, would be very similar. We know from our recent readings in 2 Timothy, the destitution of the Apostle Paul and the frailty of the truth at the time when Rome was about to advance on Israel and destroy Jerusalem. The last days, as Paul calls it, were a very difficult time for the truth. But the truth is reborn sometime after the destruction of Jerusalem, and it begins to flourish again in the Roman Empire, as Pliny lamented to Emperor Trajan about 50 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. We read of the persecution of the Christians from Eureka this way, and it has a remarkable note in it. Pliny says of his persecutions of Christians, "And this was the account which they, the Christians, gave of the nature of the religion they once had professed, whether it deserves the name of crime or error, namely that they were accustomed on a stated day to meet before daylight and to repeat among themselves a hymn to Christ as to a God, and to bind themselves by an oath with an obligation of not committing any wickedness, but on the contrary, of abstaining from thefts and robberies and adulteries. Also of not violating their promise or denying a pledge, after which it was their custom to separate and to meet again at a promiscuous, harmless meal from which they last practiced, however, had desisted after the publication of my edict, in which, agreeable to your orders, I forbade any society of that sort. On which account, I judged it the more necessary to inquire by torture from two females, who were said to be deaconesses, what is the real truth. But nothing could I collect except a depraved and excessive superstition, Deferring, therefore, any further investigation, I determined to consult you, for the number of culprits is so great as to call for serious consultation. Note that the number of culprits that they were calling Christians was so great a mere 50 years after the destruction of the brethren in AD 70. This contagion of the superstition has spread not only through cities, but even villages in the country. Not that I think it impossible to check and correct it. The success of my endeavors heretofore forbids such desponding thoughts. For the temples, once almost desolate, begin to be frequented, and the sacred solemnities which had long been intermitted are now attended afresh. And the sacrificial victims are now sold everywhere which once could scarcely find a purchaser. Whence I conclude that many might be reclaimed, that is, reclaimed from Christianity, were the hope of impunity on repentance absolutely confirmed. So what a contrast this is to 2 Timothy, where Paul is lamenting the dispersal of the apostles from the truth and the desperate position of his position in Rome. But now, the contagion of superstition of Christianity, as the pagans called it, had spread throughout all their cities and even the villages, says Pliny. And as I said, this would be about 50 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, wherein Paul died in that persecution. But true Christianity came back to life and continued in a beloved state until Pergamos is mentioned in Revelations, where Balaam again entered the ecclesia and began to destroy the truth. The time period, Brother Thomas says, was about 190 A.D. So again, from the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. to the entering of Balaam into the ecclesia in 190 B.C. is about 120 years. And so we learn from this that the truth is a very weak and difficult thing to keep alive for any extended period of time. The truth comes to light and people are fervent in it and they believe it earnestly and they practice it, what we might say, religiously. But then, as generations go on, it loses its interest and its intrigue and becomes boring to people and they begin to fall away. Well, Brother Thomas brought the truth back to light in 1847 from the fogs and superstitions of the world around him. If we look to the 120-year time frame for keeping to the truth alive, we would come to 1968, right in the middle of the lifetime of Brother Grocott, or at least the work of Brother Grocott. And so keeping the truth alive in a time when it was dying out, and dying out hard in the Christadelphian movement, became the lifetime task of Brother Grocott. Brother Grocott had seen firsthand much of the corruption of the truth, though he was not old enough to have experienced the division of the Bereans away from Central in 1923. He was born July 1st, 1912, in Southampton, England, so he would only have been 11 years old at the time of the Central Berean Division. And it was also in 1923, the year of the division, that his father moved from Southampton to Winnipeg, Canada. But in discussing the things pertaining to the 1923 division with him, it was obvious that he had a complete and detailed understanding of both the issues and the brethren involved, which he probably had derived from his father, also Gilbert Grocott. Gilbert Grocott, that is Rean's father, knew personally Brother Frank Janaway, and he and Brother Rean had visited him in Britain in 1933, when Rean would have been 21 years old. Rean's father was an architect, and he had been employed by the Russians to build an automotive plant in Russia, in Moscow. And thus Rean traveled with his father over to Europe, and he knew these brethren personally. Rean traveled with his father and had an extensive knowledge of the brethren in Britain and the details of the 1923 division, though, as I said, he had not been old enough to actually live through it. But with this background, Rean found himself, as a grown man, dealing with the appeals from Central for fellowship for reunion. In 1939, this would be about 16 years after the division, in 1939, A.D. Strickler of Buffalo, New York, died. Of course, he had been the cause of the original division over his teachings on the nature and sacrifice of Christ. Also, the brethren who held the Dawn view on marriage and divorce had left the Bereans in 1940. So this really set up a time right for an appeal for union by the Central Brethren. The Central Meeting in Los Angeles, California, issued a 10-point statement, which John Carter, then editor of the Christadelphia magazine, presented to the Bereans as a basis for reunion. This is the same 10-point statement that the Bereans later adopted and is a part of our Berean restatement. Brother Grocott worked with a group of brethren who looked past that 10-point statement and looked past all the appeals that the brethren were making to come and unite with Central, and just simply tried to get Central to explain their position on fellowship. Brother Grocott and Brother George Gibson, Brother Harry Deacon, and a few others wanted Central to explain what had happened, in their opinion, in 1923, and whether or not Central was going to defend those principles going forward. Birmingham Central took from 1943 to 1947 to answer these questions. And their answer was entirely unsatisfactory. Their answer was essentially that the Birmingham Temperance Hall had acted correctly in 1923 and would act the same way again. This correspondence is documented in a little work called The Detroit Conference, and it's in a speech recorded in that pamphlet by Brother Harry Deacon, given in Detroit in 1947. The relationship then between Brother Grocott and John Carter, the editor of the Christadelphian magazine, over those years leading up to 1952, into the 1952 division, had deteriorated. So Brother Ream did not really relish the reunion or talks about it. He pretty much discouraged it wherever possible. There had been some cooperation between Brother Grocott and John Carter in the reprinting of the Pioneer Works, but it started to break down when John Carter complained to Brother Ream about the Dawn Fellowship publishing one of Brother Robert's works, which, if I remember correctly, was Christendom Astray. And John Carter made the comment that the Dawn doing this without his permission, that they were worse than the alien. And Brother Ream found John Carter's suggestion that he could control the dispersion of Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts' works appalling, to say the least. And then a prominent member of the Central Assembly in Britain, who had a doctor's degree in chemistry, a PhD in chemistry, printed a children's book with a picture of children around the Christmas tree. Brother Grocott wrote to John Carter, thinking to add to the protests he must surely be getting over the introduction of Christmas into Christadelphian assemblies. Instead of being taken that way, John Carter ridiculed Brother Grocott, who had referenced the author's title of PhD and referred to him as our philosopher brother, PhD obviously meaning doctor of philosophy. John Carter didn't understand the reference, and he thought Brother Grocott an ignorant rube for making the reference to philosophy when the brother's degree was in chemistry. And the response then, and he responded in quite a condescending manner, and the discussion pretty much went downhill from there. So when you consider the direction Central was going and introducing such worldliness as Christmas into their documents and books, and their unwillingness to admit that their actions in 1923, which formed the division in the first place, had been wrong, this didn't give Brother Grocott much encouragement to go forward and try and move towards a reunion with them. And this started a break between Brother Grocott and many of the other Berean ecclesias who were looking more positively towards reunion and who were unwilling to re-examine the 1923 division. In spite of Central's unsatisfactory answers on fellowship, a conference took place in Detroit in 1947, the conference I referred to earlier, and no agreement could be reached with the Central Ecclesias there on two issues. The 10-point statement was accepted by 10 Central meetings, but rejected clearly by two, which were Philadelphia and Buffalo. Buffalo, of course, is Strickler's home ecclesia. It became obvious that these ecclesias were unbending in their opposition to the 10-point statement. And realizing this, John Carter introduced for the first time the challenge that some Bereans, like Brother Grocott and like Brother Deacon, believed Andrewism. And also, what was called Clause 5 in the Detroit Conference, and it's the same Clause 5 as is in our restatement today, which is a complete refusal to go to law or use the law courts against one another. That clause also was rejected by the Central Brethren. And as I said, even before the Detroit Conference, Brother Grocott saw no reason for reunion talks with Central. Following 1947, he made it clear that he would no longer entertain any suggestions for such talks. Thus, he refused all further discussion on the matter. John Carter then looked for other brethren through which he could bypass Brother Grocott, finding Brother John Randell, Brother William Bigger, and Brother Carl Wolfe. These men organized the Jersey City Conference in 1952, where an unsound reunion took place on the basis of the Jersey City Resolution, a resolution that ignored both the objections already raised concerning the 10-point statement in Clause 5 on not going to law against another, but also ignored Birmingham Central's unsatisfactory statements on fellowship. It is notable that the three men who organized the reunion, Brother John Randell, Brother William Bigger, both withdrew from Central and died out of Central Fellowship, having withdrawn from them for teaching error. The third, Brother Carl Wolfe, perhaps the most vocal of the three, stayed in Central, trying to correct what he acknowledged to have been a mistake, making appeal after appeal to Central to return to the BASF, the Birmingham Amended Statement of Faith. If you asked Carl Wolfe what went wrong with the reunion forged at Jersey City, his blunt answer was always, and this is a direct quote, "John Carter lied to me." Brother Grocott did not go to Jersey City in 1952, nor did he ever regret not going, though I certainly grilled him on it several times. He told me this, his thinking at the time, and really his thinking his whole life, was that he did not want to appear to the brethren, he did not want it to appear to the brethren that he accepted the premise that reunion talks were taking place. There was no sound basis for reunion from his point of view, and he didn't want to lend his name to any such effort. In retrospect, the only advantage he could see from going was that at Jersey City, Brother Harry Somerville had sat in the front row with his hand up with the intention of introducing the 10-point statement as a basis for reunion. John Carter ignored Brother Somerville throughout all the meetings and refused to call on him. Brother Reen told me that he didn't think Brother Carter could have ignored him had he been there. So the 10-point statement could have been introduced, but Brother Grocott didn't think this would have changed the outcome at Jersey City in the slightest. Discussing the circumstances around 1952 with Brother Grocott, I came away with two fundamental lessons from his life. He warned me, first of all, that you don't have to fight every battle. He warned me that if you fight every little battle that comes along, when the big and important battles come along, people will have tired of listening to you and find it easier to ignore you. As most of you know, I'm still working on that one. Brother Grocott had fought most every battle in his youth, and he had fought every battle hard. So hard, he believed, that he lost his effectiveness to work with the brethren. This explains the difference of opinions that I had of Brother Grocott than that which my parents had, who knew him prior to 1952. I saw him as one of the most loving and humble and patient men I had ever known. He was the perfect teacher for me, as he never tired of my constant and perhaps too detailed and too technical questioning. My parents, on the other hand, saw him as overly critical, stern, unbending, somewhat eccentric. But they had known the earlier Reen, the one who, as a member of the Detroit Ecclesia, objected to the Canton Ecclesia for wasting money on an organ. So upset was Brother Reen at what he considered the waste of the Lord's money that he had written Canton that he could never pray in the Canton Hall due to their wasting of this money. To the contrary, the Reen I knew had taught me that the most important rule I should live by was that I should be absolutely sure that whatever I said and did was done out of love. His quote was, "If it can't be done in the true spirit of love, even if you're right, it shouldn't be done at all." even if you're right, if it can't be done in love, don't do it at all. This represented a change in the attitude and the actions of Brother Reen over time, a growth we all need to go through. Out of the humbling experiences of 1952, he developed a complete willingness to be used only for the upbuilding of the brotherhood. And he also came to and teach us the importance of the scriptural teaching that we are all brethren, not leaders and listeners. In that same spirit, he always encouraged us that the high gathering should retain its name of the High Gathering and not take the name used among other Christadelphian groups such as the High Bible School. A school encourages a teacher-pupil relationship. It's the first step towards the clergy, he warned. And he was so correct on this. In a recent discussion I had with a fellow from a Christadelphian assembly in Britain who was attacking the foundation Christadelphian teachings on the sacrifice of Christ, I pointed out to him that many in Central still believe and teach the same things that the Bereans teach. He assured me that no CMPC-approved speaker, that is, no speaker approved by the Christadelphian Magazine Publishing Committee, could teach that Christ needed to offer for his own sins. By attempting to control the speakers for their assemblies, they have progressed past teachers and pupils of the past and now have formed lists of approved and unapproved speakers, and yet another step towards forming a clergy. The older Brother Reen got, the more removed he wished he could be from the leadership positions which we forced on him. In a discussion I listened in on one time with a sister, suggesting the truth didn't afford her many opportunities as she could not give exhortations or lectures, Brother Grocott responded that he often wished that he were a sister, so that his studies and work would not be interrupted by the need to write exhortations and letters and lectures, and the letter writing required and the energy required to fight the battles in the truth. And one of the lessons he tried hard to impress on me was that the desire to lead automatically disqualifies you as a leader among God's people. We must always desire to serve, never to lead. If we lead at all, we lead by example. The second thing Brother Reen warned me about as responsible for the 1952 division was the reading of the central writings in the Berean meetings. He firmly believed that the readings of central authors set these men up as teachers and authorities in the Berean meetings and made contradicting and opposing them more difficult. We who know the truth are apt to disagree with this idea at first glance. We don't read any authors, let alone central authors, to teach us, but rather to give us opinions, positive and negative, by which we sharpen our own opinions and understandings of the truth. And this is, of course, quite true. But we fail to always understand that in an ecclesia, there are always numerous generations, and the generation behind us are still in the process of learning the truth and forming their own opinions. And so the younger ones do read not to sharpen their thoughts, but to form them. And it was not the Bereans of the 1920s and 1930s who introduced these authors to the Berean ecclesias that created the division in 1952. Rather, it was the next generation, that of the 1950s, those who had read central writers introduced by older brethren, who read them to learn and to form their opinions, these are the ones who created the division in 1952. The second major challenge to Brother Grocott in his walk Zionward was the ongoing reunions in Central after the Berean Central Division. These had created a dissatisfaction among certain ones in Central. Some of those which had gone away from the Bereans in 1952 were among that group. Having created a division among the Bereans in 1952, John Carter began working on the other divisions in the Central body. 4 years later, in 1956, he forged a union between the Suffolk Street ecclesias, who had been out of fellowship with Central since 1885, when they had left, refusing to accept the Bible as the complete and infallible Word of God. The union between Suffolk Street and Central was formed over a document called the Final Statement, where the ecclesias were accepted into Central if, by a majority vote, their ecclesia passed the Final Statement. But of course, with that majority came the unsound minority. The following year, in 1957, John Carter worked with Cyril Cooper to form the Cooper-Carter Addendum, a resolution which permitted and acknowledged reservations the Australian Brethren held toward clauses 5, 8, and 12 of the BASF. This brought into Central Fellowship the Shield Assemblies in Australia and New Zealand, who had been out of fellowship since 1902. It was Brother Henry Sully, the author of The Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy, who had traveled to Australia in 1902 and examined John Bell and proclaimed his teaching as error. As might be expected, these reunions created more division within the Central Assemblies, and many started to come out. Prominent Central Brethren like C.A. Taylor and B.S. Snelling were encouraging division over these new unions, and they chose for their battle cry that they were a continuation of the sound Central position prior to 1957. Well, having a great deal of sympathy for these brethren, Brother Grocott immediately raised the objection that we were separated from Central prior to 1957, and he did not consider their position to have been sound. To address this challenge, Brother Grocott with Brother Gibson wrote the Berean Restatement, which was intended not to add anything to the BASF, but to be an explanation of how the clauses in the BASF were to be understood. The new body being formed out of the Central Assemblies was called the Old Paths. When they were given the restatement to examine, they objected to Clause 5, just as Central had in 1947. This exposed the fact that many in the Old Paths held the position that one could go to law against another, though they would have limited it only to divorce. Indeed, Brother Deacon himself had weakened the Berean position in 1947, calling Clause 5 concealed the Clapham Ultimatum, which was the ultimatum which had led to the formation of the Dawn Fellowship in 1940, we referenced earlier. Brother Deacon eventually joined with the Old Paths Brethren. But the objection raised in Britain to the Berean Restatement alarmed the Berean Brethren in this country. And it also alarmed many of the Old Paths Brethren who had formed in this country. And so, in 1960, after the restatement was published, two ecclesias which had gone central in 1952, the Boston Ecclesia and Richard Ecclesia, left the Old Paths and joined with the Bereans. The Old Paths have since suffered two divisions involving this principle, the principle of going to law against another, one in 1972 and again in 1992. So the wisdom of Brother Grocott on insisting for a clear and unmistakable statement from them on Clause 5 of the restatement has proven to be wise and prudent. The restatement continues to serve us as an explanation of the statement of faith. The principles of legalism have infected Christadelphian assemblies where if you can find some way of agreeing with words while rejecting the principles intended to be defined by those words, you can still be accepted in fellowship. This restatement formed by Brother Grocott and Brother Gibson clarified these principles, which many were playing word games around. For instance, today we find Christadelphians who claim they can agree with the statement of faith, but they reject the 10-point statement, a statement which unquestionably defined the BASF for the first 100 years of its existence in all Christadelphian bodies. Clearly, then, some find it possible to claim acceptance while rejecting the principles intended to be exhibited. With reunion and union talks coming to an end by 1960, the next challenge in his lifetime that came to Brother Grocott was what to do with those few brethren that remained in the Bereans. It now became necessary for him to turn his attention to strengthening the things which remained. But how was this to be done in a religious movement as old as the Christadelphians had become? This could only be possible by a return to those principles which the movement from the start had set in motion. And the answer to this came from the work, came out of the work of forming the restatement. It took nearly 3 years to get almost perfect agreement on the restatement. The hang-up had been over Clause 6 and statements concerning divorce. While all brethren opposed divorce for any reason, many agreed with the position of Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts that Jesus allowed divorce for one cause, which was adultery. Getting any statement which excluded the teachings of Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts proved to be impossible, and no suggestion to do so could receive acceptance within the brotherhood. Brother Grocott himself commented that even when earlier in his lifetime he believed that the positions taken by Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts on this were wrong, he still considered it impossible for himself to take a fellowship position which would have had the effect of breaking his fellowship with Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts. This was the primary reason why he could not embrace the Don position in 1940, though generally at that time he agreed with them. So when it became necessary to focus on how to strengthen the things that remain, it became the most natural thing for him to advise the brethren in the most strongest terms possible to read the writings of the pioneers, read the writings of Brethren Thomas and Roberts. And this became the constant drumbeat throughout the Berean Fellowship. Read the pioneers, read the pioneers, and read the pioneers. What a stark contrast this had become with many of the Central Assemblies who, in 1966, were very much in the process of undermining the foundation teachers, that a new foundation could be built. As we said earlier, the 1960s were 120 years since the uncovering the truth from the error by Brother Thomas. So as we might expect, we find words like this coming from Central at that very time. This by Harry Whitaker. It's a quote. "Is it not high times that the iron curtains fashioned in the Victorian workshop be rolled up? Or shall their rust continue to be a witness against us now and in the days of judgment?" So the question asked by Harry Whitaker was, if the doctrines formed in the Victorian workshops, by which he means the doctrines formed in the early periods of the truth, which happened to be in the Victorian age, he asked if those doctrines were to be a testimony against modern-day Christadelphians. The implication being that the foundation doctrines upon which the Christadelphians were based were old and outdated and ready to rust away. Brother Grocott's movement then to bring back the teachings of the pioneers and make everyone in the body well-versed in those subjects became quite a contrast. Now, there was another similar effort being made in the Christadelphian world. We mentioned that in 1957, the Shield Assemblies from Australia were brought back into fellowship, and with them came a man who was Brother Grocott's contemporary and, frankly, a man who was a fairly vocal critic of Brother Grocott, which was Brother H.P. Mansfield. Now, Brother Mansfield recognized that he also was in a very difficult position. Brother Mansfield was a sound and faithful brother in the truth in all things except fellowship. And he could see the rapid state of corruption then engulfing Central in the late 1960s, just as Brother Grocott could. To try and stem this tide, Brother Mansfield adopted exactly the same method as Brother Grocott did for the Bereans. His battle cry turned out to be, "Read Eureka." He too made a concerted effort to encourage the Central Brethren to engross themselves in the pioneers' writings. In 1972, both brethren, Brother Grocott and Brother Mansfield, had their convictions to their foundation position of the Christadelphians challenged. The Bereans were being encouraged by a group of brethren to endorse 4 points on marriage and divorce, points which would put them out of fellowship with Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts. At that same time, in Australia, the teachers of the John Bell heresy, which were attacks on the nature and sacrifice of Christ, led by one notable teacher named Herb Twine, stepped up their boldness of their teaching in contradiction to the truth. And a magazine named The Believer magazine came into print, whose stated editorial position was to oppose the teachings of H.P. Mansfield. In combating these attacks, Brother Grocott continued his appeal back to the pioneers. In a letter to all ecclesias in 1972, Brother Grocott placed before the Brotherhood all the known writings of Brother Roberts and Brother Thomas on the subject, and asked the Brotherhood if they were prepared to withdraw fellowship from those who laid the foundation for the Christadelphian movement. As we all know, overwhelmingly, they were not. In Australia, Brother Mansfield also first appealed to the writings of Brother Thomas and Roberts. In a lecture given by one of Brother Mansfield's strongest supporters, Brother John Ullman, they made this appeal to the Brotherhood as to the necessity of maintaining the truth in purity. And this is from his 1972 lecture, which those who were in Central, which I was at the time, meant that we knew that this meant that they were in the process of leaving Central. The quotes from Brother Ullman's lecture was this first. I want you to know that Brother Roberts once wrote these simple statements. The doctrine of fellowship is a fence around the truth. It is a hedge which separates the light from darkness. And those are beautiful words, and they are true. The doctrine of fellowship is a fence around the truth. It is a hedge which separates the light from darkness, and it has ever been so. John Ullman continued in that lecture, and he said, Now I want you to listen to another few words from Brother Robert Roberts. Listen to this, our beloved Brother Robert Roberts. Why this narrow basis to define faith at all? Why stand apart from the pleasant popular communion? Why not leave all questions to individual convictions and individual rights? By the time this point was reached, the whole edifice of apostolic faith and practice is discovered in this 19th century by unresolved submission to the authorities of the Scriptures would be in ruins. Would be in ruins. That's the end of his quote. So faced with this terrible trial, Brother Mansfield also referred back to the pioneers to make his points and to try to bring the brethren through this ordeal. Brother Mansfield went to England. And when he came back, he called off all discussion and separation from the error which was overrunning the Central Australian assemblies. And he continued to fellowship this error. We are now 38 years past those days, and both brethren, Brother Grocott and Brother Mansfield, await their master. When we look at what has become of their work, what do we find? We find the Berean ecclesias in nearly the identical position which they were in 1972. We hold fast to the BASF and the restatement, insisting upon it in fellowship. What has happened to Brother Mansfield's work, which came to be known in Central as the Logos faction, named after Brother Mansfield's magazine, The Logos? Logos finds itself now in shambles. Its ecclesias have shrunk greatly in numbers, particularly among the young. Brother Mansfield's heir to the magazine, Brother Graham Mansfield, has had to change memberships from his home ecclesia to a neighboring ecclesia, to escape being disfellowshipped, and unjustly so. A prominent preacher of the John Bell heresy in Australia boasted last spring that he had more invitations to speak than he could answer, while Brother Mansfield can scarcely find a podium open to him. That had been Brother Graham Mansfield. And also we see letters exchanged among Australian ecclesias where they counsel each other to work earnestly to undermine the work of the Logos magazine. In other words, as John Ullman warned in that speech in 1972, if they have failed to abide in the doctrine of fellowship, they would find themselves in ruin, which is true today. This is the true wisdom in closely following the teachings in the Scriptures as counseled by Brother Grocott. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And Brother Grocott constantly reminds us, even today, through his three collections of lectures which we have, called Be Ye Transformed, how important it is to sincerely and dedicatedly abide in the divine teachings. In passing through Texas one year, Brother Mansfield stopped off at High. After a few days, he left, commenting that the gathering was shallow. And no doubt it seemed so to him, with our focus on first principles in the evening lectures, in our daily Bible readings classes. But 70 years later, we are still the same peoples, while his movement, with their sophisticated teachers and deep studies of words and subjects, have all but lost the truth. But with all the criticism that Brother Mansfield had of Brother Grocott, Brother Reen would not tolerate any criticism of Brother Mansfield. "He is the best they've got," he scolded me on more than one occasion. "We should encourage him." And that, after Brother Mansfield had accused us of being hirelings and cowardly fleeing what he perceived to be the central flock. And after he had complained to Brother Reen of Sister Gibson's baptism when she left Logos Central and joined the Bereans. Brother Mansfield complained that if Sister Gibson needed to be rebaptized, then Brother Gibson should be disfellowshipped for marrying out of the truth. But Reen remained focused and calmly explained how such matters are handled. So it's easy for me to conclude that the greatest testimony to Brother Grocott's work in the truth was in identifying the age of our movement, how historically we were in position to begin dying as a body. And so Brother Grocott labored hard to make us a born-again new group, a new, fresh group of Christadelphians individually grounded in the teachings of the pioneers. Not an old group bored with the foundation teaching and so with itching ears looking for some new thing. A stream is always purest at its source. He took sixth-generation Christadelphians like me and like others sitting here and showed us the source from which our ancestors drank, and showed us what to drink. But perhaps above all else, he was able to explain the concept of righteousness and to give us the courage to walk righteously in an age when the concept of righteousness was greatly under attack, if not ridiculed altogether by the world around us. I once asked him, "How do you respond to the criticism that the Bereans are holier than thou?" He answered that he wouldn't respond to that at all. The Scriptures counsels us to be holy. So if people find us holy, why should it concern us? If the man making the charge is doing so despairingly, then it is not clear that such a man dislikes holiness. He went on that he found it similar to those who criticize us using the Bible verse in Ecclesiastes 7:16, that be not righteous over much, neither make thyself over wise. Why shouldest thou destroy thyself? There are countless verses which exhort us to be righteous and wise, and one verse that warns us to not to be righteous over much. And that ratio represents how much concern we should have about the matter. The boldness that he taught us to strive for holiness and to refuse to back away or make excuses for holiness is a boldness that makes the world very uncomfortable. Our discussion this weekend reflects some of that boldness. There's no secret that the writings of Brother Thomas and Brother Writings, where the teachings and the principles of righteousness are found, are under attack in a great many Christadelphian assemblies today. Those of us with contact with the other groups are often ridiculed that we have no original thought, that we consider the pioneers to be inspired, and other implications being or that we are ourselves too stupid to have original thoughts. We hear that the writings of the pioneers were good for the discovering of the truth, but now they have moved on and become wiser, and they have built on the foundation laid by those pioneers, so that what they teach today is better. But Brother Grocott taught us something different. In his letters to the Brotherhood in the time of trial in 1972, Brother Reen wrote that there was no brother alive with a tenth of the scriptural understandings as Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts. And he said he happily placed himself in that category. Anyone honestly reading Brother Thomas would have to come to that same conclusion. And so this becomes a huge problem for those who wish to undermine the principles of righteousness as defined in the Christadelphian movement from its beginning in 1847. Their words were too powerful, their logic too clear, their explanations too obvious. The only solution for those wishing to build a new and different foundation for Christadelphians is to discourage people from reading them altogether. Hence, a gathering where we boldly and unabashedly examine the men and their works is a complete anathema to them who wish to leave them altogether out of the Christadelphian movement, or even on the trash heaps of Christadelphian history. We must realize that it is not the men. In fact, we have spent really very little time this weekend talking about the men. It was their work, their insistence on righteousness, their steadfast holding to the divine principles, which is despised and ridiculed. and that is why the men are attacked. In a recent discussion I had with a fellow from one of the Christadelphian assemblies in Britain, he quoted me Hebrews 9:12, that Jesus had obtained eternal redemption for us. And while that is, of course, true, I pointed out to him that the "for us" in that verse is in italics and should not be translated. In fact, the verb is in the reflexive tense, indicating something one does to or for oneself. If anything, that verse should be translated that Jesus had obtained eternal redemption for himself. His immediate response was, "Why are you reading Robert Roberts? He never even studied Greek." The fellow made no effort to combat the idea advanced, just attacked the person. Indeed, I hadn't even mentioned Brother Roberts by name in making the argument, but he recognized the argument as coming from Brother Roberts, and he sure didn't want to deal with the argument, so he attacked the man. Brother Roberts never studied Greek. Well, whether he studied Greek or not, it is not hard in this day and age, with all the grammatical helps available, to discover whether or not they are right. And when we look at all the modern helps, we see that the word is, in fact, in the reflexive tense, as Brother Roberts said. And the newest Bible versions, like the Analytical Literal Translation, are actually translating the reflexive tense there. Their translation says, "He himself obtained eternal redemption." So Brother Roberts' argument, whether he studied Greek or not, was correct. And this is what modern Christadelphians want to shelter themselves against. And to do this, they must discourage us from reading and studying the pioneer writings. So we ourselves need to not focus on the men, focus on their arguments, not be dissuaded by those who would discourage us to do this or those who would attack the men. Let them attack their arguments and see if they will stand. We know through a lifetime of study, they will not. For in those foundation days, the brethren were steeped in the Word and dedicated to it, and they learned what the truth was. And we do our best to follow after their examples and learn the things that they taught. We might not be distracted by this Laodicean age in which we live. Thank you for your time.